Well, it's Tuesday, January 16th, 2018, and you know what that means? This is the Takeaway Podcast.
This is the Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us today. And we begin with a look at the program at the center of a fight that could shut down the government this Friday and change the future of 800,000 young immigrants.
And there's just so much pressure. Because knowing that, you know, with DACA, like, it's such a great opportunity to have permission to study, to be here.
I just don't know what to think anymore at this point. Like, I live my life in a mystery.
It tore down my self-esteem because I worked so hard for over 10 years, and then to be told, oh, you can't do this, not because you're not good enough, because of your legal status, something you can't control.
Every day, I just like, I'm a mystery jack-in-the-box. Like, hey, here's what's gonna happen to you. So, you know, there's not gonna be where tomorrow I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. Sure, I can apply that to my academics, but like socially and like mentally, like, I don't know.
Those are DACA recipients at Lafayette College in Pennsylvania. They were interviewed by Andrea Bonilla, a sophomore film student at Lafayette, and a DACA recipient herself who came to the United States as an undocumented immigrant from Ecuador when she was 5 years old. Now, the future of young people like Andrea has been thrown into doubt. President Trump rescinded DACA in September, and it's set to expire in March. Congress now is trying to come up with a legislative fix that the president will sign. And meanwhile, a federal judge in San Francisco ruled over the weekend that DACA must continue for now because the Trump administration suspended it illegally. DACA recipients were allowed to apply for renewal this past weekend under that order, but the whole program is now in a state of uncertainty and confusion. We'll get the story from Congress in just a minute, but first we go to Andrea in Easton, Pennsylvania. Andrea, thanks for coming back.
I'm happy to be back.
Well, Andrea, you've been working on a documentary featuring the stories of DACA recipients like you in your film program there at Lafayette College. Who were some of the people that we heard from there just a minute ago?
It was one of them was Diana, Sylvia, Julius, and Kat.
Talk about their stories just a little bit.
Well, for Sylvia, who I'm most close with, she's my roommate. She actually has so much at stake. She has three other siblings, and DACA being rescinded for her means that they could end up in an orphanage if she gets deported and her parents get deported. And so she walks around every day with that weight on her shoulders. And Julius as well, he talks about how instead of focusing just on his academics, he has to worry about whether he's going to have to leave the country. Whether it's tomorrow or next week or after he graduates, and he just doesn't know what to do, how to make future plans.
Sylvia is your roommate, is that right?
Yes, she is.
Andrea, what does she say to you when you guys are hanging out about this, you know, this anxiety, this pressure that she feels for herself and for her brothers and sisters?
Well, one of the things she told me that left me in shock was that we basically became criminals at the age of 5 and 6 without even doing anything. Ever since we've come here, we've had this label on us. And that, like, really touched me. It was, like, one of the things that inspired me. I became a criminal at the age of 5. And we basically get treated as if we were criminals because we can't apply to certain jobs. We can't apply to FAFSA, we can't do this, we can't travel abroad, and it's because we have this label on us as if we were criminals.
Well, Andrea, you know, a lot of DACA recipients are now in a kind of revolving limbo. You mentioned it. Uncertainty when President Trump rescinded the program. Now more questions as lawmakers of both parties are struggling to get a deal with the president and the decision from the courts as well. You've been through some of that anxiety yourself. Tell me how you've navigated the renewals and the deadlines so far.
Well, I was able to renew my DACA in November because mine was set to expire in January, which was before the deadline. So I was happy that I was able to renew my DACA, and now I can stay here legally until 2019. But it's definitely been an emotional roller coaster. At moments, I felt paralyzed because I didn't know how to move forward. When I didn't know if the degree I'm working towards every day is something I'm going to be able to use for a job. But I definitely keep pushing forward, and I hope that one day everything I work towards will be worth it, and I will have the opportunity to apply to be a citizen or the opportunity to study abroad.
So I know you're watching Washington and all these debates that are going on, Andrea, in addition to keeping up with your schoolwork there at Lafayette College in Pennsylvania. Do you have a fear that if a deal's not reached or it's the wrong kind of deal, that you could graduate college and then have to go?
Yes, that's always a fear. I'm basically working towards this college degree, and the day after my graduation, I could be deported. And that's like a sense of fear and anxiety that I always do have with me. Like, I just can't let it paralyze me.
I imagine you probably never spent as much time watching Congress so closely as maybe you do right now, because, boy, it really matters what they decide this week or in the coming weeks.
Yes, for sure. This past semester, and of course right now, I've always been checking up on the news, and it can be like a huge mental toll on you. One day it's, oh, it's good news, the next day, oh, it's looking bad. So it's definitely, I feel like I'm being played with, because it's not just news. This is my life and I have to live through this, and whatever decision they make, it can completely change my life and what my future plans look like.
Well, people in Congress are having lots of talks this week, Andrea, about the future of this program. I guess the future of your friends and you and your ability to stay here. What would you like them to keep in mind as they weigh all the different options for making a deal here?
Well, I think that DACA students need to be given a path to citizenship or residency, because DACA gave us a work permit and protection for deportation, but there was never a path to citizenship or residency, and we weren't eligible for FAFSA or internships and programs. It frustrates me that DACA was taken away when it wasn't even enough to begin with, because it just gave us a little bit of protection, but it didn't give us much.
Andrea, you're saying that DACA allowed you to simply not be deported, but didn't really allow you the ability to get legal, to get documented, and to build a life here.
Yeah, it didn't give us that path. It's important because most of us grew up here. Personally, I came here when I was 5 years old, so I started kindergarten here. I've gotten my entire education here, and when people are like, oh, why aren't you a citizen or a resident? It frustrates me, because if I could, I would become a citizen or a resident. But the only way I can do that is if I get married, and that's my only option. And people don't realize that, because people think, oh, DACA students, like, why aren't they citizens? If they work so hard, why can't they work so hard to apply to become a citizen? And the answer is simple. If we could, we would, but there is no pathway to become a citizen. And we work so hard every day. We work twice as hard as everybody else, while we still have this fear of, like, being deported. And I think we deserve credit for that, because we aren't guaranteed a day here, yet we work twice as hard as, like, everyone around us.
Andrea, thanks for coming back on and talking with me.
You're welcome.
Well, DACA recipients like Andrea and her classmates are watching Washington closely now as lawmakers on Capitol Hill try to negotiate some kind of fix to the DACA problem, while a spending deadline and a possible government shutdown loom this Friday. Rachel Bade is a congressional reporter for Politico, joins me now from Capitol Hill. Hi, Rachel.
Hey, Todd.
Well, Rachel, in all the glare of the president's remarks last week and the federal court decision forcing deferred action to continue, it got a bit lost that key lawmakers, Republicans and Democrats, reached a compromise last week on DACA, and then the president killed it. What happened?
Yeah, we don't seem to be seeing a lot of progress toward a deal on DACA, unfortunately, for folks like Andrea, your previous guest. There was this notion last week when President Trump brought in Democrats and Republicans for this sort of open negotiation session on what to do about Dreamers, that there was progress being made. There was a lot of people saying, oh, we're going to get a deal this week. But privately, a lot of people acknowledged that that was sort of just a show for the public. And both sides were really entrenched in their positions and were staying there. Then the next day, obviously, we had reports about a bipartisan breakthrough in the Senate. And the president pretty much killed that right away, saying it was a step backwards and he wanted more concessions from Democrats. Add on top of that, these sort of vulgar remarks he made about countries in Africa and immigrants from Haiti and African nations. And things have really broken down on the Hill. I can tell you that there's sort of a bunch of partisan finger pointing going on right now, with Democrats pointing to the president's comments and sort of being worried about actually negotiating with the president on this, afraid that their base might not have it. On the other side of things, you know, Republicans are trying to sort of glaze over that, some of them saying maybe it didn't happen, but saying that Democrats are going to try to shut down the government to save Dreamers, and it's just a complete mess up here.
So, Rachel, this week then, how much pressure is there for a deal now? Because Democrats in Congress have been under huge pressure from pro-immigration groups, Latino groups, to force a deal on DACA or force a shutdown. But this week's spending deal, does it give them the leverage to do that, or are we looking at a temporary deal that means more deal-making on DACA later?
I think that all depends on how far Democrats are willing to go to push for a deal on DACA. For the past few months, we've basically seen Congress kicking the can down the road every couple of weeks to buy themselves more time to negotiate on a long-term spending deal and a fix for Dreamers. The issue is that a lot of people are getting sick of Congress kicking the can down the road. So Democrats are feeling this sort of outside pressure from outside groups to draw a line in the sand this time and say, no, we're not going to kick the can down the road for another month. We're going to shut down the government right now if we don't get a deal. The issue there is that there's a fear amongst some Democratic leaders that if they do that, that they will be blamed by the public for a shutdown and accused by Republicans of shutting down the government to protect undocumented immigrants. And they're worried about that. So the question is, are they willing to risk it? TBD, we are waiting to see that right now on Capitol Hill.
And Rachel, Republicans, can they avoid getting leveraged out by Democrats here and just kicking the can themselves for another few weeks?
Not exactly. In the House, Paul Ryan has been able to sort of cobble together his conference to pass a short-term government funding bills without Democrats. But in the Senate, they need 8 Senate Democrats. So Schumer, Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader in the Senate, he's going to really have to keep his folks together, his caucus together, if he's willing to take this to a shutdown.
Rachel Bade on Capitol Hill for Politico. Thanks, Rachel.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us this hour on The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. When people in Hawaii got an alert of an imminent missile attack over the weekend, part of the terror was that the idea of the threat wasn't remote. North Korea has been busy over the last year testing ballistic missiles with longer and longer ranges, now with the ability to reach the United States. And the question for the rest of the world, how to slow down or stop North Korea on its nuclear march? Well, foreign ministers from some 20 countries are meeting in Vancouver today with that very problem in mind. The United States is pushing for enforcement of tougher sanctions as the best deterrent for North Korea. Many other countries are looking for engagement. Well, back in September, a spokesman for North Korea's Sanctions Damage Investigation Committee insisted that those sanctions cause a colossal amount of damage to his country, but that they haven't stopped North Korea from becoming a nuclear power. So we put the question to experts, are sanctions on North Korea working? Anthony Ruggiero is a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He spent 17 years as a U.S. government official and an expert on sanctions, and he participated in nuclear talks with North Korea. Anthony Ruggiero, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
How long has North Korea been under economic and trade sanctions, and why do they appear not to have worked?
Well, you know, you can trace targeted financial sanctions against North Korea back to at least 2005. There were certainly sanctions before that time, but 2005 and just after it was a renewed focus on North Korea's nuclear weapons programs. Of course, they tested their first nuclear weapon in 2006. And part of the reason why it has not worked is a quantitative and a qualitative reason. The quantitative is we just simply have not had enough sanctions against North Korea. You know, since February 2016, sanctions have more than doubled, which, you know, really cuts against the myth from some folks that there was not more to sanction or that North Korea had been sanctioned out. Because, of course, that's only 2 years ago. And then the second one is qualitative. So the qualitative is, you know, are we going after North Korea's international business? And are we going after non-North Koreans that are facilitating Pyongyang's sanctions evasion? And up until recently, up until this administration, the answer had been no. And this administration deserves credit for doing that. But of course, they haven't gone far enough. So, you know, that's part of the back and forth on why sanctions haven't really achieved their goal yet.
Well, let's talk about what we are sanctioning now within and without North Korea. What's the basic strategy? What are we cutting off? What are we putting pressure on?
Right. So now, you know, we've really moved toward targeting commodities. It started really at targeting the revenue that was directly related to the weapons programs and the revenue that was helpful for that. And now that has moved toward commodities such as coal or oil and other commodities. You know, in the end, North Korea still needs items for its weapons programs overseas. There's less of those items that they need now, so that's an area that can be cut off. And North Korea relies on this revenue stream, whether it's legitimate items like coal, or now those are legal items, but at least they're an actual item, or they're counterfeit items like cigarettes or drugs or other things that they've done in the past.
Anthony, let's talk about the humanitarian cost of sanctions. How do we weigh that cost, you know, weakening the economy in North Korea, food shortages, with the desire, the need to force North Korea to a point where they feel an incentive to negotiate? How do we think that through?
Right. I think we have to evaluate North Korea for how it is and not how we want it to be. I think that there are a lot of amazing humanitarian organizations out there who have a singular focus on making the lives of the North Korean people better. And the unfortunate thing here is that the North Korean regime couldn't care less about that. The North Korean regime does not care about their own people. So this is not simply a circumstance of this is a regime that's buying food or medicine and that sanctions are closing up that channel. This is a circumstance where the regime has no care for its people and is happy to use that as an excuse to lessen the sanctions. The last point I'll make is that the UN has studied this. You know, the UN panel of experts has studied this, and they have, you know, they have shown that the sanctions have not had the stated effect on humanitarian operations. So, you know, there's some conjecture out there, but there hasn't been really any evidence that's been presented of it.
So, Anthony, what's the best strategy in your view for all of the countries participating in this conference in Vancouver, assuming that they have one goal, which is to stop North Korea from further developing its nuclear program or to denuclearize? What more could sanctions be doing now? What exactly should these countries be doing together, in your view, to stop North Korea's nuclear ambitions?
Right. You know, a meeting of like-minded countries, as I like to describe it, is very similar to what happened with Iran. And I'm encouraged to see that coming together. You know, I think they can, you know, it certainly looks like one of the areas they're looking at is maritime interdictions. That's an area that needs to be focused on. You know, the North Korean shipping fleet is one that's very large and diverse. And as we learned late last year, it's using other vessels to do ship-to-ship transfers. So I think that's an area that can be focused on, you know, focusing in on the role of China and Russia. I think there, you know, there's certainly been some criticism that both of those countries are not in Canada, but the reason why they're not in Canada is because they're not partners in this effort. They are, the best word I could use is, in at some level, they're obstructionists when it comes to this. You know, the issue here is that sanctions are going to create the leverage for real denuclearization talks. And if barring that, it would allow these countries to protect themselves from North Korea's provocations and proliferation. You know, we have to be cautious about the North-South, the inter-Korean talks. You know, this is really an effort by North Korea to try and delay sanctions. These are not, from my mind, real negotiations. The North Koreans have already gotten the U.S. and South Korea to delay military exercises. And now that they've pocketed that, the North Koreans are making further demands. And we have to remember, all North Korea is really doing is sending 500 people to the Olympics. So North Korea is not really doing anything, and we're sending them the wrong message. So I think that sanctions have to be used in combination with diplomacy. But this is not the diplomacy where we need to start to roll back sanctions.
Anthony Ruggiero, former U.S. government expert on targeted sanctions, currently senior fellow at the Foundation for Defensive Democracies. Anthony, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow, we'll hear from the other side of this debate, someone who thinks that sanctions are not the way to get North Korea to the negotiating table.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering storage solutions for business, including file folders, banker's boxes, and storage bins for getting organized. More at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, it's pro time.
Missouri Governor Eric Greitens is an up-and-coming star in the Republican Party, or at least he was until last week. Greitens admitted to rumors of an extramarital affair, but then denied allegations that he took unwanted photos of the encounter and used them to blackmail the woman into silence. Now some lawmakers and observers are calling for his resignation. Jason Rosenbaum is a political reporter for St. Louis Public Radio and co-host of the podcast Politically Speaking. Hi, Jason.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, Eric Greitens reached national attention this past week, probably for reasons that he didn't want, Jason. What did Missourians already know about Governor Greitens before this scandal news?
Well, the governor came into office on a platform that emphasized both his resume and his character. They knew that he was a Rhodes Scholar, a Navy SEAL, the head of a charity that helps veterans get on their feet after combat. They obviously didn't know that in the run-up to him running for governor, he was engaging in an extramarital affair. And it really blows a hole in this image that he has showcased to Missourians as a man of character and a man of conviction. And a lot of people are questioning if they were duped during this campaign by not knowing this information.
So Greitens seemed like the kind of politician who fit the profile for the upwardly mobile political career, relatively young, Navy SEAL, military background, Rhodes Scholar, you mentioned it all. Allegations of an affair and also alleged blackmail. What do we really know?
Well, we know that he had an extramarital affair because through his attorney, he has admitted that to numerous reporters. His attorney has strongly denied, though, the second claim that he blackmailed this woman into not revealing the affair. The second thing is what is catching most people in Jefferson City's attention. Even some Republicans that work well with the governor have said that if the blackmail allegations are true, that he should resign pretty much immediately. The circuit attorney in St. Louis, which is the prosecutor here, is opening up a criminal investigation into the blackmail allegations. And there's still a lot of unknowns here because the woman involved is not speaking publicly. The tape recording that was in the news report that broke this was supplied by the ex-husband of the woman. So there's a lot of unknowns at this point, and that's why I think some Republicans that are in the Republican-controlled legislature are taking a wait-and-see approach.
And it sounds like the kind of sort of salacious political intrigue that maybe people in Missouri aren't exactly used to, Jason. Eric Greitens' own political style up until this point, how is that playing into how other politicians are handling the story and how the media is handling it?
You don't really see a lot of Republicans defending or standing up for the governor right now because he had a fairly contentious relationship with elected officials. He came into office with rhetoric chastising, quote, career politicians. So it's not super surprising that a lot of elected officials from both parties aren't exactly eager to stand up and defend what the governor did here and to try to save him politically. It also doesn't help him much that Missouri's lieutenant governor is also a Republican, and the lieutenant governor and governor have had some disagreements over major policy issues, including a popular tax credit known as the low-income housing tax credit that the governor basically halted. So because of these policy and personality differences, you're not really seeing a lot of groundswell support for the governor right now. And while you may see kind of a domino effect of resignation calls, if there's any more information that comes out about this situation or potentially other ones.
And before we let you go, Jason, does Eric Greitens have a strategy to prevent this from derailing him altogether?
Right now, he is laying low. He canceled a statewide tour promoting a tax cut proposal he talked about in the State of the State. He's not talking directly with any mainstream media outlets right now. We'll have to see whether that strategy remains fruitful, given that other politicians in Missouri who have run into this sort of trouble have gotten through it by talking with the media.
Jason Rosenbaum, reporter, St. Louis Public Radio. Thanks, Jason.
Thank you.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. And New Jersey gets a new governor today. Democrat Phil Murphy is set to be sworn in Trenton. But this is one new governor who could have big implications for the national political scene. Murphy cruised to an easy victory in the Garden State, campaigning on big liberal issues. And both Democrats and Republicans are now watching New Jersey closely to see where the political winds might be blowing. Dave Weigel is national political correspondent for The Washington Post. He's here to explain. Dave, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, Dave, Phil Murphy ran on championing a lot of big ideas of the left. So remind us, what's he for?
Well, he ran on a $15 minimum wage. He ran on what he called, at one point, sanctuary state policy. And he's kind of dropped that term, but he still wants to create a state bureau that would deal with undocumented immigrants. He wants to legalize marijuana. He wants sick leave, paid sick leave for everybody. He wants the State Bank of New Jersey as a way to shore up the finances. And he wants to pay for some of this with not just a tax on marijuana, but a special millionaire's tax.
So, Dave, there are a lot of Democrats in New Jersey in the legislature. In fact, they control things. Could Phil Murphy get this program done?
That's actually where the drama comes from. In New Jersey, they have majorities that were able to block a lot of what Chris Christie wanted to do. The wrinkle is that they're not necessarily liberal majorities. They're like a lot of northeastern Democratic states where the balance of power is a couple conservative Democrats. And they, after the election, said they were welcome to the millionaire tax. Since then, since the passage of the federal tax plan, they said that might not be doable. They need to find some way to rescue people from being hit by the changes to these tax code first. With a lot of the economic policy, he needs to get it through some skeptical Democrats. With things like immigration policy, he was optimistic that he could do a lot of that without even going to the state.
So, Dave, Democrats have been having this big internal argument for years. You know, what kind of party do we want to be? You can think of the shorthand, you know, like Hillary versus Bernie, barely left of moderate, essentially pro-corporate, party of the establishment, make sure you appeal to moderates, or embrace the economic needs of the middle class and low-income workers, sort of a Bernie Sanders model, minimum wage, single-payer health care, those things. Is Phil Murphy trying to use New Jersey to prove the concept here?
Yeah, I mean, he blanched a little bit when I suggested this could be a discussion forced into the rest of the country the way that Scott Walker forced a discussion from Wisconsin to other states. But he really wants it to be a model. The way that California and Minnesota governed for the last 8 years, that's what he wants in New Jersey. And that's, with all due respect to California and Minnesota, states that are not part of the country's main media market, what they did was covered, but not covered as intensely as what happens along the East Coast. And so what he wants to do is prove that you can raise taxes a little, pay for a lot more services, pay for infrastructure, rail, for benefits for everyone, no matter what their job is, and that it'll work.
And Dave, do you think that Phil Murphy's apparent path here, this proof of concept that we're talking about, could teach Democrats how to act in 2018 or 2020? Does it have big implications for a national election potentially?
Oh, absolutely. A lot of what he's doing here is going to be followed because a lot of it's part of the Democratic discussion. I think if a Democrat won 2020 and had a Democratic Congress, I think, for example, paid sick leave, paid family leave would be right on their agenda. And we know it is with people like Kirsten Gillibrand and Elizabeth Warren. That's been on the agenda. $15 minimum wage, same thing. They've already signed on to that. What they want to be able to say is that these policies have been implemented in the state and they've worked, and we're going to go run ahead and use them. they haven't had a good example of this in a very long time. So I think they're going to look at New Jersey, root it on, root for them to actually do these things, pass these bills, and then adopt them when they run for office in their own states and for the presidency.
New Jersey, a potential proving ground, a potential microcosm for national politics in America? Who knew? Dave Weigel did, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
We turn now to a case before the California Supreme Court that could have major implications for social media privacy. It involves a murder that took place in San Francisco back in June of 2013.
It was sort of a gang-related shooting, the police say. A 19-year-old was shot. A 14-year-old ended up being charged with a crime and then incriminated his brother. And the case came down to motive and witnesses.
That's the familiar voice of Andrew Cohen there, senior editor at the Marshall Project and author of this week's Case in Point. Motive and witnesses, Andrew says. Seems simple enough, but that's where things get messy.
The defense thought, since this was evidently a gang-related shooting, and that the defendants in the case said that the victim had threatened them via social media, that they wanted access to the social media accounts.
So the defense team subpoenaed Facebook and Twitter and other social media platforms, trying to get access to the accounts in question to prove self-defense. But the company said they were legally forbidden from giving up that information, all because of a federal law dating back decades.
Under the Stored Communications Act, which was a 1986 law, there is an exception so that these media companies can obviously keep the privacy rights of all their customers, and they can't disclose information that, say, you and I would ask for. But there's an exception that allows for police and prosecutors to get access to social media accounts, for example, with a search warrant or a court order. And usually that's what happens. The prosecutors or the police, the investigators, get that warrant. They say, look, we need to search this because there may be evidence of a crime in it. And the companies turn it over. There is no such exception for defense attorneys. So when defense attorneys want to get access to social media information from these companies, and they try to do it through a subpoena, the companies, in this case, in other cases, say, sorry, we just can't do this because of this old law.
There seems to be a little bit of a disparity there, Andrew. But before we get to that, talk about why that disparity in disclosure is so important in this case. What allegedly went on between the victim and the perpetrators here that makes social media posts so important?
Sure. Well, the defendants in the case say that the victim in the case, the young man who ultimately was shot, was threatening people with violence. So obviously, if you're a defense attorney and you're preparing for a murder case, and there may be evidence that the victim in the case was threatening your client, you want that information. You want to evaluate how direct the threats were, whether there were actual threats at all, because that obviously goes to the motivation for the crime, that goes to a self-defense motive even. It's key information if it exists. And what happened in this case, the defense attorneys subpoenaed these big companies, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, trying to get access to this information. They know that there is some information out there. They just don't know the details of it. They couldn't go to prosecutors because prosecutors either hadn't gotten the material or got the material and weren't saying whether it was exculpatory or not, so that their obligation to turn it over to the defense hadn't yet triggered. Prosecutors say in the case, look, don't ask us for help. You're the defense. You need to do this by yourself. So there is now before the California Supreme Court this case that's going to hopefully answer some of these questions. What the defense attorneys say is, look, we need to have a level playing field, and these companies can't hide behind these old this old law to say that they're going to produce in some cases and not produce in others.
Well, big social media companies in general resist attempts to get them to give up information, whether it's under warrants or not. So what are they saying here?
Well, what they're saying here is we are afraid that if we give this information to the defense in this case, we are violating our obligations under this law to our clients, our customers, and they're going to turn around and sue us. The defense says that's nonsense. That's not going to necessarily happen, especially if the requirement comes from this case, from a judicial order. But you have this, what I found to be this just really disparate treatment in this case. You would think that the information that's being sought here, being relevant to a defendant's fair trial rights would trump the privacy concerns expressed in the law. And that's really what this case is about. The defense is saying, listen, these clients, our two clients, have constitutional rights to a fair trial. They have constitutional rights to try to get as much information that they can before the trial, and that it's useless to wait until the trial and then have a request made that's then going to just delay the outcome of the case. So this has been brewing for a long time now. This is going on 5 years since this murder, and obviously this has to be resolved before the case can go to trial.
And Andrew, this case is currently in front of the California Supreme Court, but the Stored Communications Act is a federal act, and this is definitely an issue with national implications. Why is it in state court for now?
Well, it's in state court for now because that's where the discovery fight is, right, in the criminal case. The criminal case obviously is a state case and not a federal case. It's a state murder trial. So you're going to have this ruling one way or the other from the California Supreme Court, and then it's going to be fascinating to see what the companies do if they lose, what the defense is going to do if it loses, whether this is going to try to find itself to the U.S. Supreme Court. You know, the U.S. Supreme Court can take cases out of the state court systems, especially when they involve questions of federal law. I don't want to predict that this is a case that the U.S. Supreme Court would be interested in, but it is a case with larger implications. There are, you can imagine, plenty of different scenarios across the country where a defense attorney would want access to this information, and these companies would say, no, we can't give it. We'd like to, we're sorry, but we're bound by this law. And so it's the interpretation of the law that's going to matter here, this old 1986 law.
We'd like to, we're sorry, but we're bound by the law. Meanwhile, prosecutors can get the information. That seems like a situation across the country that eventually is going to be ripe for review here.
It is. And one of the fascinating sort of angles to this story is the companies in their briefs are saying to the defense attorneys, why don't you ask the prosecutors for help? Let them get access to this information and let them share it with you. And of course, the defense is saying, no, no. The whole adversarial system in criminal justice is that, you know, we don't share with the prosecutors our tactics and our strategies and what information we're trying to get before trial. And the prosecutors are saying the same thing. Look, we don't want to help the defense here. We don't want to serve as an errand boy or errand girl for the defense as it tries to get this information. If the defense is going to get it, it's going to have to get it itself.
Andrew Cohen, senior editor at the Marshall Project and author of Case in Point. Andrew, always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Over the weekend, a 23-year-old female photographer recounted her experience of a date and a sexual encounter with comedian and actor Aziz Ansari last fall. She says that on that date and in the encounter, her verbal and nonverbal cues that she was uncomfortable when ignored. She told the website Babe that it was the worst night of her life. Aziz Ansari was the star of the comedy Parks and Recreation and creator of the Netflix comedy Master of None. The woman hasn't revealed her identity, but she says she felt pressured into a sexual encounter with Ansari. I believe I was taken advantage of by Aziz, she said. Aziz Ansari responded saying the encounter, quote, by all indications, was completely consensual. Now, a lot of people have pointed out that the lines in this story can feel especially blurry, and it's opened up a new chapter in the conversation about consent in this Me Too era. As part of our weekly conversations about women and gender issues, we asked Koa Beck of Jezebel and Jessica Bennett of the New York Times to give us their take.
Jessica, what do you make of the allegations against Aziz Ansari?
So this, naturally, much like every other case we're seeing now, has prompted this whole new debate. Is it sexual assault? Is it possible to not consent, but also not be assaulted? Mm-hmm. What this particular case and the detail that was given in the story opened up for me anyway was this larger conversation I think we should be having about coercion, about the ways that young men are taught to pursue sex. Mm-hmm. If you are a man and you are taught by every force, whether it's pornography or pop culture or film and television, that your entire goal is to essentially take what the woman says and keep pushing it and mm-hmm. pushing back until she relents, that script for how we engage in sexual interaction feels very wrong. Koa, what do you think?
There is a really prominent quote that there is a discrepancy on who originally said, but it's been filtered down into internet memes and exists a lot on Pinterest, that women are not slot machines that you insert kindness coins into until sex falls out. this operates from a place that sex is the goal above all else and mm-hmm. that sex is there for you. Mm-hmm. So it's just the Rubik's Cube of getting it.
I was reminded of a piece I had done a couple of years ago about consent training programs on college campuses. And there's a sociologist named Harry Broad who studies consent and masculinity. And he basically talked about how, you know, dudes are taught that getting to eventual consent is the goal. Like, push her just a little bit further, one more drink, like, no is negotiable. And the way he described it was, quote, a lot of what we as young men learn as seduction is really like preparatory sexual assault training, which to me completely resonated because the descriptions in that piece, that's what it sounds like.
I also don't really see the point of a consent-based conversation if consent is something that can be eroded.
What do you mean by that?
That if consent is something that you force out of a woman, consent loses its importance in this conversation. Does that make sense?
Well, that's the idea of enthusiastic consent, right?
Right.
What a lot of the college campuses have done with programs around affirmative enthusiastic consent is that the idea is you need to be enthusiastically saying that you want to do the thing at every step of the way. Like, consent can be withdrawn at any point. You can change your mind. Like, all of these things are okay. You can do one thing and not another thing. Like, you can't assume from any one behavior that a next behavior is entitled to you.
Yes. I think Grace's indication that she had been presenting consistent physical cues that she was not interested in engaging in this behavior says a lot about the conversations we will not have surrounding sex top down. A big part of this that I have not been seen talked about enough within Me Too is that we do not have comprehensive sex education in this country. States can decide how they want to present sex education. They've found ways, especially in the Bush administration when I was growing up, to block certain comprehensive sex education. All this does is mute and stifle conversations that young people need around sex, and not just the ability to talk about it, but also to identify consent when it's there. When you stifle conversations like that and you don't allow them to exist in a setting in which kids can ask questions and understand sex, it's basically a tunnel to porn, which is performance-based. Porn is not an accurate depiction of sex. And yet more and more young people consume porn, which I think warrants a separate conversation entirely. But the fact that they are not consuming that alongside any authentic conversation around sex, I think, is a problem and presents us with this terrain in which cues are being misread. People don't necessarily understand how to talk about it in the first place.
I think that by the time we are learning about consent, I mean, when did I learn about consent? Like, after college. I mean, like, I'm older. I'm not of the generation where this conversation is happening all the time, but certainly not in high school when I was first sexually active, you know? And, like, certainly not in middle school when I should have been learning it in order to be healthily sexually active in high school.
I will add, I think what this case indicates to me, especially in a post-Weinstein climate, is that we need a more nuanced understanding of what consent is in the first place. Because all the various responses to this indicate that everyone is operating on a different plane of what consent even is.
I totally agree. And the understanding levels are so different. And, you know, the fact that in this case, as described, there were verbal and visual cues that were not picked up on. And so what is that telling us about the way that we're communicating?
That's Jessica Bennett, gender editor of the New York Times, in conversation with Koa Beck, editor-in-chief of Jezebel. And we've been asking you, how are we communicating about consent to our own kids?
Hi, this is Crash calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And my wife and I definitely do talk about consent with our child. Our son is only four, but we always tell him he does not have the right to touch anyone's body without their permission, and then no one should touch his body without his. We also constantly try to reinforce that he needs to think about how others might feel before he acts. You can never start too soon.
This is Jermaine from Florida. We talked about attitudes, viewpoints, and behaviors. There was no subject that was off limits. Relationships can be very difficult, and we wanted our sons to think about them from all angles.
And we got this from San Geronimo, California. My college and high school kids are giving consent talks to younger kids. My middle schooler is well-versed as well. It's a hot topic. And from Brigham City, Utah, we're teaching our children about consent in all situations. It can be applied to anything, playing with toys, hugs, sharing food or drinks. We teach them to look for a yes or no and to reconfirm by asking if everything is still okay. Is it okay that I'm still using your toy?
This is Andrew in Kalamazoo, Michigan. My kids are 6, 4, and 1, so we haven't yet talked about consent explicitly, but we are consciously teaching them consent and bodily autonomy in a way that feels like a fundamental building block that we want them to carry into their adult relationships. Speaking up and the freedom to say yes or no is all it entails.
Tell us how and if you talk to your own kids about consent. We're at 8778-MY-TAKE. And remember, you can find all of our weekly conversations with Koa Beck and Jessica Bennett at our website, thetakeaway.org/MeTooMemos. In the meantime, thanks so much for being with us today for this hour. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Progressive Insurance, offering Snapshot, a device designed to reward safe drivers. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's progressive. And Staples, offering storage solutions for business, including file folders, banker's boxes, and storage bins for getting organized. More at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, it's pro time. Want to bring The Takeaway with you on the go? Subscribe to The Takeaway as a podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
PRI, Public Radio International.